Support for Modern Love comes from Living Proof. Living Proof.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Proof knows you have more important things to do than styling your hair. Get styles that last two times longer when you use their Prime Style Extender. Use the code PRIME at livingproof.com for a free travel size Prime Style Extender with your $20 order. We are the science. You are the living proof. And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will deliver seasonal recipes with pre-measured ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals for less than $10 each. Get three meals free with free shipping at blueapron.com/modern. That's /modern. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. This week, we're going to share some moments from our live performance at Town Hall in New York City on October 20th. You'll hear a reading by David Harbour, the Tony-nominated actor who plays Police Chief Jim Hopper in the Netflix hit series Stranger Things, and music by Lucius, who arranged their own version of our theme song. Ophira Eisenberg, comedian, writer, and host of NPR and WNYC's Ask Me Another, emceed the event.
How about a hand for Lucius, everybody? Starting us off with the theme song for the Modern Love podcast. Welcome, everybody, to Modern Love Live. Very excited to be here. My name is Ophira Eisenberg. Thank you for the clap, and
it's fine.
No, so, yeah, sure. Thanks. I welcome you to one of the venues I love the very most too in New York. It is an absolute pleasure to have everyone here for this great show in Town Hall. And my name is Ophira. If you never heard of that name before, that is fine. It is not a made-up name. I was asked that today. Did I make up that name? Yeah, that's how it worked in my family. We all got to make up our own names. No, it is actually, you've never heard it because it's a really, really old Hebrew name that didn't catch on. So we have a wonderful show for you, as you can tell from the programs that have shown you the amazing people that are going to come out here and read some incredible pieces about modern love. I'm originally Canadian. We walk amongst you undetected. few other Canadians, fantastic. And I moved to New York as a single person for reasons, obviously career and whatever, but also thinking I would find love here. And I moved here 15 years ago, and I remember at the time when I lived in Toronto, I loved Sex and the City, and I thought it was this very over-the-top, ridiculous representation of dating in New York. And then I moved here and realized it was a documentary. And it was hard on me. I dated online and offline. It wasn't called real life. And pretty, you know, yeah. There's an interesting thing when, you know, I'll tell you how dating works in Canada. It works very differently here. This is how dating works in Canada. You sit at a bar, and someone buys you a drink, and you date them for 10 years. That's how it works. Yeah. Like, you want to break it off around the 7th year, but you're, like, too polite to deal with it, so you just let it go on till one of you moves. But here, I felt like people approached it much more like a buffet. where they would be like, no, I don't want that, or maybe just one of those, or, you know, I'm going to have the eggs and the cupcakes because I can have it all, you know. And it bothered me. I went out with some really nice guys. I went out with some, as it turned out, not the greatest choices. I think one of my favorites was I went home. I was living in Manhattan, and a guy asked me a question that I had been really avoiding the entire time I'd live in Manhattan, which was, would you like to come back to my place in Queens? Seems so far. I didn't know the trains. And, you know, I was like, I was going. That was the whole point of us hanging out. So I went to his place. And I'll never forget this. He put, you know, we were making out a little bit. He put his hand on the doorknob to his bedroom, and he said, would you like to see something special? Yeah, the answer to that is no. And you button up your coat and you get out of there. But I was in this very, you know, fun, positive phase. I'm Canadian. I didn't want to be impolite. So I was like, oh, yes, I'm so excited. Something special. Fantastic. But then as he was opening the door, my brain started to reel. Like, actually, what am I dealing with? Like, is it going to be another man or a dead body or bunk beds? You know, like, what am I up against? And it was none of those things. What it was is that this guy had his room was filled with like 300 or so Garfields. Yeah, the stuffed cat. He was a Garfield collector. Yeah, you can't see that coming. You know, there was a big one on his dresser. It was very alarming, this sort of shrine to Jim Davis. And I honestly didn't understand what, you know, if this was supposed to, how this was supposed to make me feel. Like, was I supposed to be excited by this? Or, like, you know, if I did well, would I get them? Like, I didn't... So that one didn't last long. But then, soon after that, you always remember the one right before the one, I guess. I did meet my husband, very, very sweet guy. The only thing actually I didn't like about him at the time is that he was very nerdy. He's a comic book nerd, but he is very good looking, and that is the great combination, right? Right? Low self-esteem, but attractive. Get him, you know? And and we sort of made our way through New York. And actually, even though I'm a little old to be saying this, I, you know, have a new love in my life, which is we had a baby almost a year ago. We have a little, thank you. It's very weird identity. That's a new identity thing for me. And I am older. When I was pregnant, I was considered both high risk and an inspiration. and it's really, I mean, of course, I love this little baby. I have a boy. He's a boy for now. And it is everything that everyone said it would be, of course. The one thing it has very much impacted, though, I would say, is, yeah, it's just changed all my relationships, because I've been with my husband for 10 years, but this is the first time we have spent this much time together because of the baby, and it turns out that he is just okay. You fight a little bit more. It's a little more intense. We've had some super stereotypical, we had a very stereotypical fight. He said to me, since I've been married to you, I have never been right. I was like, well, you were just then. So that's one. But yeah, it's a pretty incredibly odd thing to have all of this, especially in this town. I live in Park Slope, Brooklyn, which is the natural place to raise a child in New York, I guess. I mean, actually, when we got our lease, that's when I got pregnant. It was something to do with the paper. And but it's very people do judge you on your child rearing choices. We are doing something very controversial, I believe, in Brooklyn. It's called sleep training. Some people are into that. That's where you close the door and you let the baby cry himself to sleep, because I figured he should learn how I do it. And and also they're really competitive. I have a neighbor next door. It's fun because we've never become friends with our neighbors like we have now, because all of our neighbors also have little kids. I mean, the younger me when I was dating would have hated this scenario, would have thought that is death to me. But now that I'm in it, I love it. I love putting all the little babies together and looking at them, and we all coo, and they look at us, and they probably think we're ridiculous. Like, we turn into little babies somehow. But my neighbor's also competitive, because this is Brooklyn and this is New York, and people here have a lot of ambition. That is, I found that all through my dating life, that people had a lot of ambition, and now I'm finding just my neighbor, and she's competing with me with our babies, who are the same age, and they're little babies. They don't have much, they don't have accomplishments yet, a matter of fact. But she's at 3 months old, she was like, Bernadette is holding up her head? How's Lucas doing? That's my kid. I'm like, Lucas is holding up his head high. And now she's like, Bernadette is trying to walk. I'm like, Lucas is teaching CrossFit. Okay, just back off. And if you're wondering why our child's name is Lucas, it is because of Star Wars. Because my husband is a huge Star Wars nerd. And I gave it, I was like, that's fine. I like the name too for my own reasons. I only like the name, honestly, because I have dated a lot of guys, so it was hard to find a name that didn't have like a memory attached to it, you know? And you know what's bad when you're like, nope, Xavier is also out, you know, like you. But Lucas worked just fine. So welcome once again. Before I begin and start bringing out our illustrious readers, I would like to thank WBUR, Boston's NPR station. Yes, that produces Modern Love, the podcast, and specifically Amory Sievertson, Jessica Alpert, John Parati, and Iris Adler. And also, of course, the New York Times and Daniel Jones, who is the editor of the Modern Love column. So let's get things started. Our first essay is Out from Under the Influence by Kevin Kaline. And to read it, we have Tony-nominated actor and star of the Netflix series Stranger Things, David Harbour. Please welcome David Harbour.
My first date with Julie did not begin well and ended even worse. For starters, I didn't show. It was Saturday evening, President's Day weekend. I was drinking gin and tonics, watching hoops in the telephone bar on 2nd Avenue, whiling away the time before I was supposed to meet her at John's Pizzeria just down the block. Next thing I knew, it was hours later, and the phone was waking me up from my slumber in my apartment on East 12th Street. I stumbled out of the building. I ran to John's, where Julie ended up crying defiantly on the sidewalk, her words lost to me, but their meaning clear. Never again. After she left in a cab for the Upper West Side, it could have just been one of those first dates from hell that eventually becomes funny in the retelling, but it wasn't that simple. We worked together. at an advertising agency. She is a human resources coordinator, and I as one of the human resources she coordinated. She was the first person I'd met at work. I'd only passed the typing test because she had added an extra 5 minutes to the egg timer. With that and a smile, she'd hooked me. I started spending my nights constructing elaborate and clever email messages to her that I would pass off as spontaneous the next day. She began to drop by my desk with a frequency that I attributed more to her need for my ragged charm than my need for the memo she was distributing. Now all that groundwork appeared lost, and on Tuesday, I'd have to face her again. I continued to drink all weekend, wallowing in regret, and on Sunday, I sent her $100 worth of roses, bought with money I didn't have, along with a note of apology. Unfortunately, I also left her a voicemail message that consisted of Hootie and the Blowfish's Hold My Hand in its entirety. When Tuesday rolled around, I stayed home. Wednesday, same. I knew that this kind of denial was not a practical long-term strategy. So on Thursday, I got dressed and I tried to return to work, but my nerves were shattered, my head cloudy. I had crossed the line, as I sometimes did, from functional alcoholic to clearly not. Finally, I called Julie. "Did you get the roses?" I asked. Yes, she had, and they were lovely, but she felt it a rather grotesque gesture all the same. "You're an alcoholic," she said, not unkindly. "You need help." I had already reached this conclusion myself at age 16, but no one had ever said it directly to me. Julie suggested I make an appointment for the next morning with a doctor. I did. I was love-struck and free-falling, and if she'd asked me to jump off a bridge, I might have done that too. But again, I stumbled out of the bed, disoriented, and arrived at the doctor's half an hour late, rain-soaked. His West 57th Street office was lush and quiet. He was bearded and kindly, but he got right to the point. "Now, what brings you here?" "I drink." "How often?" "Daily." "Have you been drinking this morning?" "Affirmative." "What about your arm?" "I have a cat." "Well, it must be some cat." "I don't actually have a cat." "I think you like to see the physical manifestation of your psychic pain." "Who doesn't?" He diagnosed me with acute alcoholism, which wasn't exactly breaking news, and recommended that I seek treatment pronto at an inpatient rehabilitation clinic. "If it's okay with Blue Cross," I told him, "it's okay with me." I was 24 years old. I returned to my apartment, where I hadn't paid rent in some time, and waited for a call from the benefits people at work. I had been with the agency for only 6 months, and only as a favor to my aunt, who'd worked there for several years. From my shaggy wardrobe to my computer illiteracy, it was pretty clear that I was not Madison Avenue material, but she had snagged me an interview anyway. Julie, my unlikely advocate, called and told me that my benefits were shipshape and that I was good to go. So I went, but not before draining several 40s to steel myself for the phone calls I had to make to family and friends to ensure that I wasn't reported AWOL. When the van arrived to pick me up, the grizzled driver told me that most people were drunker than I was. Somehow this made me feel worse, as if I couldn't even self-destruct correctly. As the van sailed north on the FDR Drive, I thought the bright lights of the big city never looked quite so intoxicating as when you were leaving. Nearly 3 weeks later, I appeared at Julie's cubicle in my only suit. She hugged me and told me I looked great. I told her she did too. She found some envelopes for me to stuff and papers to photocopy, tasks I completed with unprecedented zeal. She looked amused every time I reported on my progress and requested more work. At the end of the day, I took off my jacket, I sat in her cubicle, and I told her about rehab. "Nobody thought you'd come back," she said. As I got up to go, I briefly touched her knee as if I were some repressed character in a Merchant Ivory movie. And then I walked home through the streets of Manhattan. We met that weekend in Central Park and talked as we walked. Julie was from Canton, Ohio, daughter of a school teacher and a football coach. She was a Phi Beta something or other, and her best friend was her sister, a graphic designer in Chicago. She chose the ad agency over Merrill Lynch because it felt more humane. Me, I was just the guy from New Jersey whose path of least resistance had led through the Holland Tunnel. The recovery literature warned of the dangers of starting a romance days or even weeks, sometimes years, after coming out of the drink, but I wanted company on my lifeboat, and Julie seemed ready to grab an oar, if warily. At our next date in the park, she climbed a rock and declared me too raw to date. "I think we should just be friends," she said. I didn't begrudge her this decision. We walked across the sheep meadow and to a clearing where the skyscraping hotels of Central Park South looked luminous. And as the light disappeared behind the palisades and a full moon shone, she turned to me and said, "If we weren't just friends, this would be kind of romantic." During our hermetically sealed days and nights that followed, I made her a promise that I would stay sober. 2 months later, though, I was back with my old friends and to my old self. Julie and I attended a wedding in Jersey Shore where, unbeknownst to her, I knocked back drink after drink. I simply could not see anything past the clinking ice cubes and limes in seemingly every person's glass. I danced with the groom's sister, who whispered in my ear to give her a call if I ever decided to lose the blonde. One old acquaintance looked at me quizzically as I poured a few drinks back during our conversation and said, "You a little thirsty?" On the return to the city, we became ensnarled in traffic awaiting a drunk driving checkpoint. Terrified, I kept up the ruse by telling Julie it was a good thing I quit drinking when I did. Such is the bottomless cup of duplicity that we drunks drink from. When the officer simply waved me through, I felt such joy and relief that I vowed I'd had my last drink. And it nearly was. Just 25 months after my brush with the New Jersey State Troopers, we were married on a steamy June day in a tiny church in an industrial corner of Canton, Ohio. The night before the wedding, a group of the hopeful and faithless had gathered for the rehearsal dinner in a restaurant in old downtown Canton. There was still the requisite mix of drinks and well wishes, and I still had the sense that my mouth and arm could conspire against my brain to raise a little hell. When it came to my turn to toast, I recited the speech I'd outlined on a cocktail napkin at the Indians game the night before. I forgot every word of it now, except for the last line, which I borrowed from a Bruce Springsteen song. I promised Julie that for better or worse, for richer or more likely poorer, I would love her with all the madness in my soul. It was one part vow, one part pose, and one part roll of the dice. Then I lifted my glass in the air, and I put it back down. It's been 10 years since my last drink, and it's not like rolling a boulder up a mountain every day. In fact, it's no effort at all. I don't attend meetings, speak in jargon, or mouth the serenity prayer when flummoxed. The accumulation of thousands of days without alcohol has simply made it a reflexive non-habit. Julie and I have ordinary jobs, a home in the suburbs, and a minivan for our 2.5 children, who, genetically speaking, could have hoped for better. Soon enough, they will surely tell me so. But I don't know. The thing is, would their mother and I have ever gotten together if I hadn't been a...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Drowning alcoholic in need of her outstretched hand. Sometimes I can't help but wonder if the burdens we carry don't end up carrying us.
David Harbour.
Living Proof products make life easier. Just ask Aaron, who works at ModCloth in LA.
I work in fashion, so my hair is an important part of my outfit completion. And my go-to product that I use every single time I wash my hair is the Prime Style Extender. I love that. I love the way it smells. I love what it does for my hair. I feel like it just like polishes it up and makes it last longer without washing.
Use the code PRIME at livingproof.com for a free travel size Prime Style Extender with your $20 order.
I have a feeling this night is going to be a mixture of crying and laughter. It was very poignant and beautiful, and it's okay if you cry here. I just want to say that right now. It's okay if you feel. I have to say New York is one of the best places to public cry of all time. It really is. I mean, right? That is what, if you walk around crying, nobody bothers you. It's very peaceful. I like crying on subways. I like the letter trains more than the number trains. The ACE line is my favorite line for crying. The blue line, it's the saddest line. But it's good too, because when you cry on the subway, it's quite efficient, right? Because you are going on an emotional journey and you're going somewhere. And it's occurred to me over the, like, I've done a lot of crying over a lot of, many, actually mostly relationships, I believe, some health stuff around New York, and no one's ever said, are you okay? Or do you need something? No one ever. At best, they look at you and just give you the nod, and I think that's what it really is, because they go, you right now, but it's going to be me in a second, so it's truth. I would like to reintroduce Lucius to our stage. They are from Brooklyn, New York, if you did not know this, and they're about to go on a North American tour starting next week with a stop on Late Night with Seth Meyers, so make sure you tune into that, but you get to experience them right now. Please welcome Lucius again.
A long time that I'm almost afraid to go home. A long run.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Lucius, performing at Modern Love Live. Stick with us. There's more after the break.
Not all ingredients are created equal. Blue Apron sources fresh, high-quality ingredients and sends them right to your home in pre-measured packages. You get easy-to-follow recipes, so you can have a meal ready in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free, with free shipping, by going to blueapron.com/modern. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/modern. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Welcome back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. You just heard a piece of our live performance at Town Hall in New York City featuring Ophira Eisenberg, Lucius, and David Harbour. David read the piece Out from Under the Influence, and the essay's actual author was in the audience. We talked to Kevin K. Helene after the show.
I love David's reading of the piece. I'm so glad he was able to find the humor in it. The funny thing was, when my wife heard her name in the very first sentence, she burst into tears and she cried for the entire length of the reading. There was a real sense of poignancy in being together with two of my three kids, my mom, and having our story performed for us and hearing the positive feedback from the audience. It was pretty emotional, and it's a night I don't think either of us will soon forget.
Kevin added he lives in New Jersey and works as a freelance writer and journalist. His wife has since received her degree in teaching, a lifelong goal, and works, again, in human resources. Kevin said his youngest child, who wasn't born when the essay was published 11 years ago, has yet to read this piece, but will someday. Next week on the podcast, Issa Rae, co-writer and star of HBO's Insecure, brings us a story about the intimacy and distance of modern dating.
In the safety of my apartment, I could see Will, but I couldn't touch him. I could summon him up when I wanted to talk, but I never knew him in any light other than the one from his bedside lamp. This phenomenon worked in my favor as well. I could call him after a few drinks when I felt sufficiently talkative and social. I could avoid him if I had videos to edit or blog posts to write. I could say whatever I wanted and risk awkwardness because at the end of the conversation, one click of the mouse would shut him out of my room.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Parati, and Amory Sievertson. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Modern Love Live was produced by Pretty Good Friends. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll see you next week.